zone that is for sales.
I don't know. Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. I think if your intent is to get closer to God, it's fine. I put God on there too. You know, I had just gotten over open heart surgery and got cancer. And I just, and I'm sitting there going, God damn you. Which is kind of a paradox. I mean, that's it. And it wasn't anything serious. They just cut it out and that was it. But, and I was thinking, hey, I'm trying to do your will and you pull this shit on me? You know, give me a break. And he says, I am giving you a break. I'm having them find it before it gets any worse. So, sometimes those things are mixed blessings. I found out that God's amused at me being mad at him. You know, you try and learn from everything. Let me tell you something, and this is a good point to bring it out. I don't want to point at any one individual, but that guy wanted to argue with me about inventory, and he got pissed off and left. Right? Now, I could say you're perfectly right and you do anything you want to do, but at some point you're going to have to stand up for what you believe. And if you just cave in and say, oh, well, I know you're right, but there's so many different ways to do that. That's not described anywhere in this book. And you know what? If I cave into that, that means that I'm unwilling to stand up for what I believe. And see, one of the questions at some point that you're going to have to ask yourself is, what the hell do you stand for? You stand for anything? So, I mean, are you willing to stand up and take some abuse for what you believe because you know it's right? And what the hell do you believe? Do you ever figure that out? Do you have the courage of your convictions? Are you willing to take an unpopular position because it's going to piss some people off? Huh? Do you have that kind of courage? What if it's the truth and I make every one of you mad? Am I willing to do that? You better bet your backside. Yeah. The point is, it's either the truth or it isn't. And there's a lot of bad information floating around in Alcoholics Anonymous for a whole variety of reasons, some of which is because of crazy people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of it is from treatment centers trying to put their thumbprint on Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because of somebody that doesn't want to read the book but wants to do the program in some manner that they think is more appropriate. And so they teach other people to do that, and two or three generations of those people will be doing it and thinking it's gospel because they all did it. This is, you know, this book is written on a sixth grade basis. If you don't understand it, reading it with a sponsor, both of you are messed up.
Yeah.
All right?
What about the fact that the book, I was sure they'll say the book doesn't say anything about having a sponsor.
It says almost nothing about sponsorship.
So is that something that was made up or how did that?
Yeah, no, it talks about working with the new man. It doesn't say specifically sponsorship to the best of my knowledge, but it does talk about working with other people, and I think it's just about terminology. And then you get all of these different levels of sponsorship. I mean, where people have them calling and. It's really interesting watching other people's egos when they sponsor people. And some people will have you call them every day. Why did they do that? Huh? Right.
by the way, I don't call it sponsor.
Good.
When it says hand-to-hand, does that mean it's a two-way street that we give as much as we receive?
Well, it turns out that way.
There's some sponsors that you let me call it.
I don't. Now, this is just personal. And you know, listen to your intuition about that.
So one of the best new sponsors that you have, they're all calling you every day. So you're doing a spot phone call.
Probably. But one of my primary concerns is this business about we're on a new basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. And see, I would call my sponsor and I'd say, my boss is really mad at me. And he'd say, wow, what's that about? I'd say, well, he thought that I didn't call on the right people at the right time or whatever. And anyway, he sent me this memo that was just smoking all the way. And he'd say, well, that's really something. And he'd go on for a while. And then he'd say, well, what the hell am I supposed to do about that? And we'd talk about it some more. And then he'd say, why don't you pray about it and do what you think? You know, he did that for almost 10 years before I caught on. And I think I'm a fairly bright person. And one day I called him up and I said, I got this problem going on with my wife, but I'm going to pray about it and do what I think. And he said, huh, finally caught on, huh? And this is 10 years. So, at some point what we do is we deny our intuition when we're constantly whining to other people to show us how to take care of the challenges that we face. And what my sponsor would do with me is he'd go to God, go to God, go to God, go to God. That's what he said to me every time he suggested that I pray about it and do what I think. And see, when the book talks about intuition, it says it gradually becomes a working part of the mind. We come to rely on it. Okay? Yeah. Well, it's all right. I mean, gradually is fine as long as it's getting there. Oh, cool. It also says that we can do... It also says that we can do absurd things in following it. But usually early on. Okay, so let's just, for the last few minutes we're going to be here before lunch, let's talk about intuition. Are you willing to follow it? Huh? What if your intuition told you to take all the money out of your pocket and give it to somebody?
I would say, what? I'm coming to hear you, bro. I probably wouldn't want to do it.
Huh? You'd want to?
I probably wouldn't.
Wouldn't?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So you probably wouldn't do it. Why not? If God speaks to us through our intuition, he wants you to take everything out of your pocket and hand it to somebody, would you do it?
For me, now I'm in a place where I might do that. But before, early on, when I first started trying to, and this is a few years ago, when the first time I started that, I was thinking about this test to see if it's a condition or if it's my ego to.
Right.
It's difficult because I would take that intuition, but I know now it's intuition for a better now, and I would reason it with this defective mind, but that intuition would tell me something right. And so I run into the filter of my ego-driven mind and not do a lot of the things. I look back now, I could have done differently, and if it was intuition, but I thought I'd do that.
Everyone does. But you will eventually trust your intuition, and you won't question it if you do it long enough. But see, almost no one's willing to follow it to find out if it's true or not. It takes some courage to do that.
What you brought to me to be able to see was a if I am safe and protected by it, I'm a child of God.
Yes.
I'm safe and protected. It's okay to make a mistake. It's okay to try it, and if it blows up in my face, I try.
Yeah, it won't kill you.
The point is to try.
Did I tell you about being in Los Angeles? I'll tell you, for those of you who weren't here a couple of years ago. I had been talking to this guy in Denver who was his 6'6", 300-pound lawyer. It's a mean son of a bitch. And he, a great guy. I mean, knew more about the big book, I think, than I'll ever learn. And he was, this guy's name was Frank McKibben. He died recently, and they called him Big Frank, and he was nasty. And a confrontive and in your face, and was a physically imposing person. And he'd just get that far away from you and start barking at you, which is a really hard way for communication, especially with someone like me who wants to hit him when he wants to do that, and wondering, this doesn't make any sense at all. And he was the guy that says, "The hell do you stand for?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "If you don't know what you stand for, you don't stand for anything." That was the kind of stuff you got from him. And he'd say, anyway, so he said, "How much you trust your intuition?" And I said, "Oh, I trust my intuition." And he said, "I'd bet you don't." And he said, "If your intuition told you to do this or this, would you do it?" And it was one of those, would you give all the money in your pocket to somebody? And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Then you don't trust your intuition." Kind of black and white with this guy, and it was just in your face all the time. And it was wonderful, because most of the stuff you learn from people you don't like. So that's paradox. So I had to go to Los Angeles to an industry meeting, and I had to, after the meeting, I had to go out to John Wayne, that's still called John Wayne Airport. What is it, Orange County Airport or whatever? So I had to take a cab out to John Wayne, catch a plane back to Denver. And the cab ride was going to cost, I don't know what, $40 or whatever it was. And this is downtown Los Angeles. And then I already had the airline ticket. So I was walking down the street, and there was a bum on the street. And this guy looked really, really bad. And he was kind of wandering around looking. He looked like he's mentally ill. And my intuition said, "Give him your money." And I'm going, bullshit. Because I had like $200-$300 in my pocket, right? And my intuition's going, "Give him your money." And I'm going, this is what we call spiritual make-believe, okay? And I'm thinking, no, I'm caught up in some kind of spiritual make-believe here. And my mind is going, "Give him your money." So I took everything out of my wallet except the money that I had to have for the cab ride. And when he walked up to me, I said, "Excuse me." And he turned around and he looked at me and I said, "Here." And then I just walked away from him. And I had to walk like 2 blocks to get to a cab stand. And I thought, don't look. And I don't even know why the hell I was thinking that. And I got about a block away, and I thought, I really have to see what happened. And I turned around, and this guy was on the sidewalk on his knees, like this. And it was exactly the right thing to do. Exactly. And didn't hurt me a bit. What? We done? Okay. All right. So do you trust it or don't you? You're going to live a spiritual life or aren't you? This isn't easy. Okay? Thanks. Yeah. Okay, you ready? Okay, let's go. I can tell you what some people do at the end of their inventory. And it really doesn't address this stuff until you get into what the book says about the fifth step, where it says illuminate every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. One of the things that that I see people do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to put, when they write their inventory, they put all that take it to the grave stuff in there. That's the stuff that you wouldn't tell anybody under any circumstances. And if you do decide to put that stuff into your inventory because of what it says in the fifth step, what I would encourage you to do is to talk about that portion of your inventory at the beginning of your fifth step, because otherwise you're going to be worried all the way through your fifth step about what kind of reaction you're going to get. Chances are, if you've done it, half the people in the room have done it. So I've never really seen any kind of unique behavior from anyone. And I've been listening to fifth steps for decades, and they're just pretty much all the same. And people are terribly, terribly embarrassed by their fifth steps generally. And most people's fifth steps are so common they're boring. And it's hard to watch somebody being that uncomfortable through the whole thing when it really isn't unusual in any respect. So what do you do when you get done with your inventory? Do what? Turn it over to who? With your inventory? But what are you going to do with it? No. Somebody will find it and go, I didn't know you did that. Yes. You need to read it to someone. So, who do you read it to?
God and another human being.
Yeah? How do you pick that other human being? Yeah, you know, when Alcoholics Anonymous started, most people would use clergy to listen to their fifth step. And since then, we've kind of gotten away from that, and people are much more likely to use sponsors to listen to their fifth steps now. What you need is a closed-mouth friend. That could be a sponsor, that could be a priest, that could be a minister or a rabbi, or it could be someone else in the program that understands what you're doing. Conversely, if you're listening to one of these things, it's really good to just have one of those mentalities where it goes one ear and right out the other, okay? I mean, I've listened to, I honestly don't know how many fifth steps in the last 30-some years, but when you listen to these fifth steps, it's helpful to give people feedback about what they're reading, because you're trying to find those things that were objectionable. And most four steps have sort of trails that go through them, where there are common themes in most people's four steps, whether it's lack of control or victimization or whatever it is, if you listen to a bunch of these, you'll find out that they all sort of have threads to go through them. And when you get to the end of the fifth step, it's really helpful if you can relate those things to the people who are doing the fifth step. So when they go into sixth and seven, they know what to ask God, or what they think are objectionable to God. So how do you do that then? How do you go pick someone that can listen to this, and then what do you do? What comes next? Yeah, pretty simple. It's helpful, and you can do this or not do it, but it's helpful to just say a little prayer before you do it. God help us see the truth through this inventory. The other thing that I should mention before I forget it is when you write inventory, most of the time what I see people doing, and I do it because my sponsor told me to do it, God only knows why at one point, was I write at the top of every page in that inventory, God, please help me to see the truth. Okay? Because I'm really asking God to help me see things that I've refused to look at. So one of the things we do is when we get to the fifth step is just to say a little prayer, God, help us find the truth here, and then have the person read it to you. All right? How many people in here have done that? And what was your experience? Was it a good experience, a bad experience, an embarrassing experience, a spiritual experience? What was it? What?
Mine was a good experience.
What happened?
The person didn't leave me. They stepped
out
of your
state. Yes. And they didn't reject you afterwards?
No, they weren't even surprised or shocked or anything.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yeah, that was incredible.
So let's talk. And actually, they had a meeting on this morning. I think, was it this morning, the fifth step thing? Yeah, let's just cover that. One of the lines in the book in it is, in actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. What does that mean?
Can't do it by yourself.
Right. Exactly. Solitary self-appraisals is when you're the only one who knows what you're doing. And we usually find that insufficient. And then there's an admonition in here about you better tell somebody everything. Okay? Because they took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought that they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they have told someone else all their life story. Okay? The next one of the things here is when we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. I got to tell you, walking around with a four-step without fifth-stepping is really asking for trouble. Because then, as we talked about before, you know the problem, but you haven't gone anywhere with it. And so if you sit there and hang on to this over time, it's just going to make you crazy. It makes people crazy enough to do inventory without hanging on to it. It's like stopping in the middle. It's just going to make you really unsettled. So, We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing. See, they keep saying the same thing over and over again. Get it all out. We're delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. When this book will tell you what the problem is, what to do about it, and how you ought to feel after you do it, which is an interesting thing because you can check and see if you're getting the response that the book says you're going to get. And this whole business about being alone at perfect peace and ease is an interesting one because we're not people who come to that naturally. Most people can't be alone in an empty room without a television or a radio or some sort of entertainment device. And if they're there and they don't have any of those things, they'll get up and run out. It's just too hard for them to be there alone. And they need some sort of diversion or distraction. After I did my fifth step, I went home and sat in this big easy chair and just put my head back and tried to clear my mind. And it was clear. And I could just sit there and be there. And I could have sat there for, and I think I did, for about an hour and thought of basically nothing. And thought, how wonderful. My mind has been is quiet for the first time in my recollection. There was no 10-piece band playing. There was no 4-person argument going. There wasn't any of that stuff going on in my head at the time. And that was the benefit of having done this. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Okay. So, now we go home. We've done this fifth step. If you've got a sponsor or whoever's listening to this thing, if you have someone who's giving you some level of feedback on what the content of that fifth step was, they're going to tell you about the themes in your fourth step. They'll start telling you about, you really have a lot of issues about control. You don't like this, you do like that. You don't trust anyone. Your perception is faulty. You know what the best question my sponsor asked me, and he gets asked me over and over and over again. And I would go to him and I'd go, boy, the state just came to me and said, would you like to provide us services in this area? And I'd go, you know, Don, I wouldn't even know how to put that together. Same thing over and over again. He'd say, how the hell would you know? And it was one of the best questions I was ever asked. How the hell would you know? It's a good question. How the hell would I know? I don't know. I'm not sure I'm ever going to really know who I am or what my capacity to succeed is, but I'm trying to find it. And the one thing I do know is that I don't know. It's like trying to know God. I do know that I don't know. And I see manifestations of God, and I see manifestations of the abilities that God's given me, but it's a hard time coming to trust them. Trying to trust myself is almost as difficult as trusting God after my experience. So, um, So after we do this fifth step, we return home and we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we've done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Do you know how to do that? That's right. You know how to thank God from the bottom of your heart that you know him better? Say, God, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for allowing me to know you better. That's easy, isn't it? This is not a difficult program.
Huh?
Yes.
I've had experience with fifth steps. The first fifth step that caused spiritual voice becoming a spiritual experience was the first time I really got a sense that God gave us. Because I really felt forgiven.
Yes.
But like it had already happened, but I just wasn't looking in that direction.
Right.
And all I cared about going into this step was that one promise about the drink promise.
Yes.
And that's all that happened. That was in 20. But that was the first time that I really felt like, you know, the grace.
Yes.
The grace of removing that stuff that was blocking us. It really happened. And God did give a crap about me. I didn't notice the thing about the drink on the security until a couple of steps later, but it happened in there somewhere.
Yes.
Thank you.
We have a tendency to attribute human human behavior to God. We act like he's just a supreme person. And so if sometimes what happens is that if you do your fifth step with someone and they don't tell you to immediately get out of their lives and they accept you, it occurs to you that if someone will do that, God may do that too. And that's a new concept for most of us, because an awful lot of us grew up with this idea about a punishing God. And you know, my deal was this old man with a fistful of lightning bolts and looking for somebody to throw them at. And I came from a type of church that was almost Pentecostal in nature, and it was like, God's going to kill you. You know, you can be smitten, smote, whatever, for that. And, you know, I don't want to say, you think if that's going to happen, there's somebody walking around with a damn big club. And the idea that even in the face of the behavior that I had exhibited most of my life, that I could be forgiven was just a tremendous idea. So anyway, I went home. It says, taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. I'll tell you a funny thing. I put it up on a shelf so I could take it down. Did you do that too?
You told me to. I put it on the dresser and set it up again and put it on the shelf.
You know, that seems silly, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think I lost the argument later.
Well, the truth is that I don't want to make any mistakes here. What we're really talking about is I'm messing with my life here. You know, somebody's afraid. People are just terrified that they're going to piss somebody else off. I just say that we're going to look bad. You know, everyone's walking around thinking we're going to look bad. Just afraid that we're going to do something and everyone's going to look at us and go. You want to know the truth about that? Huh? Nobody's looking. That's the truth. Everybody's so caught up in their own stuff, they're not looking at you. They don't even know you're there. And we think everyone's looking at us. That's the epitome of being self-centered. And so the truth is, we walk around thinking we're being constantly observed. Nobody's looking at us. We really aren't that important. It's a wonderful thing to become part of the herd. It's great to come down off the mountain and understand that you're not the center of the world. Most people think that the world revolves around them. That's about being self-centered. It doesn't revolve around me, yeah. What about them? They probably are going to have to make a lot of amends. They're probably going to have to make a lot of amends. What about gossips? Then don't participate in it.
Yeah.
And here's an example of not wanting to look bad. What if you turned around and said, I don't engage in that kind of behavior? What's going to happen? Huh? They won't do it anymore, will they? Maybe they won't even come around you anymore. Huh? Yeah. And when that happens, then we go, oh my God, I lost a friend, right? So I'm going to talk about the thing that you mentioned early on, that I found out about people in general and about being liked. First of all, I don't care if anybody likes me. I just don't. If you live a life that you believe is pleasing to God and you live by a set of principles that you believe in, there's a lot of people who may not like you, but almost everyone will respect you. And I would much rather be respected than liked. You know, my relationship with God doesn't have anything to do with whether other people like me or not. So, as a consequence, I have a host of friends, absolute host of friends. And I'm one of those people who doesn't care. I mean, I don't go out looking for them. There's just a lot of them around. And it's nice to have them, but I'm not out self-promoting. They just are people who are on a common path with you, who have common goals with you, and who enjoy your friendship. And that's wonderful. Here's the truth about people. In life, there are some people who are really going to like you. And then there are some people who are really not going to like you, who are going to dislike you. And then the majority of people will be in the middle and they're indifferent, all right, to you. If you take all of those people who really like you and try and make them dislike you, they're probably going to like you anyway. And if you go to all of those people who really dislike you, and try and make them like you, they're probably not going to like you anyway. And all of those people in the middle are going to remain indifferent. So what's the point? The point is, be yourself. And the natural consequence of that is what I just mentioned. And that isn't going to change. None of us are liked universally, nor are any of us disliked universally. And so what we do is we just get rid of that whole concept and go on about trying to live a spiritual life. So we try and live a life that's pleasing to God, that's based on spiritual principles. And that's what we do. It's funny when people come and make amends to you about gossip. They say, well, they call you up for an appointment. You go, okay. And they show up and they say, I gossiped about you. And they think that's good. All right, thank you. But then your mind goes, wonder what they said. Yeah, most of the time I don't embarrass people by asking them that question, but every once in a while, if I want to put somebody on the hot seat, I do. And I say, I'd like to know what you said. So they hem and haw and say what they said, and you go, why'd you say that? They went, because this and that. And you say, what'd you do about that? And sometimes they go, well, I didn't do anything about that. And so you tell them. You go back to those people you gossip to, and you tell them you were wrong. So now, anymore, and at least in those groups that I'm in, people, if they do make gossip amends to you, come up and say, I gossiped about you. Here's what I said. I was angry at you and did this and that. I went to all those people and said I had no business saying that. Not too many people do this whole thing. You have to understand that if you're in this room and you follow these directions, you are in the minority. Okay? You can be proud to be in the minority. Yes?
You mentioned to me one time, something on the phone about, I was confused about how I was interacting with some members of another fellowship.
Yes.
And that I was giving some people in AA a little bit too much credit. And I was basing them, assuming that everybody was trying to live by the same spiritual principles that I was.
Yes.
And that nothing could be further from the truth. And
oh,
that,
my.
That which is only is absolutely true.
Yes. You know why a lot of... Huh?
It did not matter how often.
Not at all. One of the reasons why people, especially people who follow these directions, will get angry in AA is because they see other people in the program who don't have the same set of principles they do. And the nice thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you get to pick your own principles. And some people may think it's all right to do one thing, and other people may think it's abhorrent to do those things. And then they're at odds. You know, they're at loggerheads about that kind of behavior. And here's the deal. Just because you picked a set of principles doesn't mean everybody else in the world has to operate by them. All right? Just because we made a decision doesn't mean that we've imposed it on the rest of the world. So don't get mad that if you see people operating on a different set of principles, those things become their own reward. If the behavior is contrary to good spiritual principles, they'll pay their own price for it.
So if you ran into that yourself personally,
yes.
And would you go back to that meeting, or would you stay away from that meeting entirely and go to other meetings?
There's two reasons why I go to meetings. One of them is to go to the well. My home group is my spiritual well. And even though I'm the one who's longest sober in that group, there are other people that work this program just as hard as I do, know just as much as I do or more about this book. And if I am in need of spiritual sustenance, I can go there and I can get straightened out, basically, spiritually. The other reason why I go to meetings is to go to a place where they don't have a solution and to carry it to other people, whether they like it or not sometimes. This will come as no surprise, but a lot of people come to Alcoholics Anonymous for reasons other than getting sober. All sorts of reasons. Some of them aren't even alcoholics. Some of them are these sort of marginal personalities or Looney Tunes or whatever, just looking for a place to establish a social agenda, social platform. Some people go to Alcoholics Anonymous to run scams on people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and those are people that think we're stupid and gullible. And what they don't understand is that they're picking on a bunch of people who've been down some pretty muddy roads, and if there are scams around, we probably ran them at one time. So there are all kinds of reasons why people go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of them aren't good at all. I mean, they certainly aren't in keeping with trying to get spiritually fit. They're really not about solving alcoholism. They're about finding spouses. You know, at some, you can read articles in the newspaper about AA is a good place to find a husband, for God's sake. I mean, you talk about fishing in a desert. I went to get it. I do a lot of bird hunting. So you go buy a bird dog. I went to this dog breeder that had a bunch of national champions. And I said, what's the way you go out and you get a really good bird dog? And he looked at me and he said, well, you got to start with a good dog. People are a lot that way too, okay? You're going to go out and pick somebody that at least has a chance. I watch new people get hooked up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they go, I'm in love. You know, and you go, no, you're in lust. And they go, no, I'm really in love. And I go, no, you just found compatible forms of insanity. And anyway. Yeah. Okay, so we take the book down from the shelf. I'm trying to find the page. Where the heck is it? So I don't know where these pages are anymore. All right. Taking the book down from our shelf, we turn to the page that contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask ourselves if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? So, now about the time people get to that, I need to tell you that a lot of people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous have a really serious case of paranoia. And so they look at that and go, oh my God, for sure I've missed something. And I'm going to be terribly embarrassed when I have to go back to my sponsor and say I didn't tell him about something. Sometimes we do leave things out, and that'll jog people and bring them back and go, one thing I didn't tell you about. So if you've done a good inventory, if you really have tried, and you fifth-stepped everything that was on that inventory and everything that applied, that's good, all right? And then just go on to step six. If you haven't, go back and clean it up. But if you're unaware of it, don't worry about it, because you're going to have a chance to write some more inventories. And you can pick it up the next time. Now, the book says that a business that takes no regular inventory is sure to fail. So we write inventory about once a year, anywhere from a year to two apart. And the reason why is because the ego is resurgent, because the ego comes back. And at some point, it will put you in the same position that you were in when you first appeared in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you will be just as confused and just as afraid and all the rest of that stuff. And so the ideal thing to do is to sort of nip that in the bud. Now, some people in Alcoholics Anonymous will say that the 10th step takes care of that, and that all you ever have to do is write one inventory. Good. You aren't the same kind of drunk I am. If there was a secret to keeping the ego in check, I think I would have found it. But the problem with the ego and the nature of the ego is that it rebuilds. And when it gets big enough, your intuition goes right out the window. And your ego will then put you in a constant state of fear. And when that happens, for people like us, we need to do something about it. And that is, we need to deflate the ego again. And the only way I know how to do that is to go back through this process. Okay. If we can answer to our satisfaction, which is that we put the, you know, didn't make martyr without sand and all that stuff, then we look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, everyone? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. Okay, so now we've gone through this inventory and we've seen all these things that are objectionable. And we try to find the willingness to be rid of all those things. Now, in almost everyone's experience, God doesn't take all the stuff that we think is objectionable, right? Some of it's pretty rank, and he will take it. Some of it is, and it takes time to take it. We don't know what God's intent is in all this, so maybe he's going to use that, something that we think is a character defect, to his advantage. So what we're doing is we're just kind of coming back to this position about, God, I want you to be, I want to be who you want me to be. And whatever that requires, whatever you want to take away or whatever you want to add is all right with me. Just give me the willingness to be rid of all of these things that I think is a critical part of my delightful personality. So what we have to do is we have to become willing to let God change us into whatever he has in mind. Now, when ready, and now it's talking about the 7th step. If you go read in the 12 by 12, the best thing I think in there is this business about, this is the step that separates the men from the boys, or the women from the girls, I suppose. When it talks about step 7, when ready, we ask, we say, let me just tell you one thing. I told him, well, I don't get it. I told my sponsor the first time through, I said, I don't get this. I just, draw me a picture here. I'm not picking it up. And he said, think of a sandbox. And I said, all right. And he said, now think about all your favorite toys when you were a little boy. And he said, so did you have a Tonka truck? And I said, no, but I would have liked to have had one. And he said, well, put a Tonka truck in there, a dump truck. And then put a little road grader in there. And then put an electric train in there. Oh, the end loader. When I was a little kid, they didn't have end loaders. They did. That I remember, anyway. And so you put all, you know, they had bulldozers. No, well, you know, for me, I'd probably been a shovel. And so anyway, you put all these toys in the sandbox, and then you go to God and you say, I am willing for you to take every single toy out of the sandbox. All right? Even if I have this emotional attachment. So and he said that's the way you do the sixth step. You become willing to have God empty the sandbox. And see, I think in pictures anyway. So that's what I did. And then it says, when ready, we say something like this, my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Remember when we talked about going to God with egg on your face? This is going to God with egg on your face. The point is we won't go to God because we think we're going to be rejected because we're not perfect. And so we think because we've had bad behavior or because our past was difficult or whatever, that God won't accept us because we're not saintly. And the truth is God will accept us anyway. And the proof of that is every time you go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and see a whole bunch of sober people. If God will accept us, he about accept anything. Okay? And I've told people on several occasions, if I was God, I'd just kill all of us. Because we are truly not the most delightful people in the world, and we have come down some muddy roads and we have done some really bad things. And we are people who don't deserve that kind of response. But you know what? God loves us all. And the proof that God will take us good and bad is the fact that we're in here and we're alive. And that means that God truly does forgive us, or we would have never got this far. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to meet you and my fellows. He gets to choose. Thank you. Oh. Thanks, Allison. Then I get all the bugs flying around my head. I think I feel like a garbage can. So what we say is, I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows, not which stands in the way of my usefulness to me. So, okay, so now God gets to choose. What are you going to take? Yeah, whatever he wants. I told you when we were talking about the third step that there were two places in this program where you virtually have to prostrate yourself in front of God, where you virtually throw yourself at God's feet and go, anything you got in mind. I'll do anything, I'll go anywhere, I'll be anything. Anything you have in mind. Okay? But you get to make the decision. And if there is some part of my personality which I think is objectionable and you don't, it stays. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Why? Why? Yeah, but why? I mean, why is it so tough to do God's bidding? It is an unnatural act for us to do God's bidding. All right? We want to do our bidding. In the whole business about going from where's mine to what can I do for you, tr- truly is not natural for any alcoholic I ever met in my life. And yet we become better at that over time than almost anyone I've ever met. That that the whole idea of altruism, about working for others or placing others' welfare above our own, becomes a natural act for people in this program who go through this process on a regular basis. Some of the kindest, gentlest, most helpful people I have ever met in my life are people in this program who will drop everything to help you at any point. It's just amazing. But not if they're people who don't do this. If they're people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are unwilling to participate in this sort of spiritual program or do these steps, they're still out there grabbing everything they can get and thinking they're getting away with it. So, how long does this period last? Okay, well, let's start a little bit then. It says, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. What does that mean? I think that's, what book is it from? James? Where's faith without works is dead from? James? What does it mean? Kind of. Faith without works is dead. That means you can believe any damn thing you want. But if you don't do anything about it, it's meaningless. That means we turn it into action. See, you can be the most upstanding appearing member of Alcoholics Anonymous and be walking around and talking about all the good things you intend to do and where you intend to go. And I think you said it, intentions are just, or did you say that?
No.
What?
My sponsor likes to use the three frogs on a really bad story.
Oh, right. Why don't you tell them what it is?
There's three frogs on a lily pad. One of them makes a decision to jump off. How many are left on the pad?
Three. Right. That really is it. Most of the time people use that in conjunction with the third step about making a decision. But the old expression is the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So you can say or, act like you're interested in doing whatever it is, but if you don't do it, faith without works is dead. If you're not willing to stand up, if you don't have a set of principles that you believe, if you're not willing to stand for something, believing all that stuff is meaningless. Do you believe in God? Absolutely. Are you willing to follow your intuition? Not on your life. Okay? That's faith without works.
Not to discount the drivers, but interests are important, and that nothing happens without them.
True.
Intentions get them themselves.
Right. I think most of this stuff starts with good intention. And
for me, what hope is not planned. It's kind of the biggest get stuck with in your way. It's kind of like you're saying, faith without works is dead.
Right.
And at least now I do have good intentions. Before I didn't have that either.
Right.
Occasionally here and there, but now more so than that. And what I